Hello, dear pod people. Sorry, correction, dear pod people. Had to get rid of 50% of the deer. This particularly youthful-looking podgram was originally a programme on BBC Radio 4 on the 7th of March 2013, and on it we had Spuds and Space, the Cosmic and the Cosmetic. We explore what it is about that most adaptable vegetable, the potato, which means on average everyone alive gets through over 30 kilograms of them a year. We'll go from Herschel to partial to spatial shutdown to explain why the largest orbiting telescope of its kind is hotting up and shutting down, and we'll examine contrasting evidence as to why we wear makeup. And by we, I mostly mean women. I'm just naturally baby-faced. First, having started with the badgers, now they're coming for our deer. Red, roe, seeker, fallow, muntjac and Chinese water deer. Together, they're more abundant and widespread than at any time since the last ice age. But being free-roaming and prone to hanging out in woodland, no one's been too confident about their exact numbers. Now, researchers from the University of East Anglia have attempted to work out how many are out there and the impact of current deer management, and concluded that just to stabilise the population, let alone reduce it, we'd need to cull more than half of them, which some estimate would mean killing over 750,000 deer. Is that doable? Is it even thinkable? On the line is Dr. Paul Dolman, lecturer in ecology at UEA. Paul, if accurately estimating numbers has proved so tricky in the past, how have you got round that?
Counting deer is a challenge. They're cryptic, they are shy, they hide in woodland, and consistently their numbers are underestimated. If you just walk through a woodland, see how many you see, you'll only be seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of the population. So we use two things. Firstly, we use technology, thermal imaging. So we went out and counted them at night when they feel secure. They think that you can't see them. So they are much less likely to move away from you as you approach.
So you don't end up counting the same deer twice or missing some deer, yeah?
Yeah, well, you will miss some deer. So there, we use the thermal imaging equipment, which, you know, shows deer even that are hiding behind bramble bushes. You see these bright glowing green blobs of heat. But we use this in conjunction with methodology called distance sampling, which is, you know, a very widely adopted methodology for sampling animal populations. Because a deer that is very, very close to you, you won't miss it. A deer that's slightly further away, you've got a good chance of seeing it. A deer that's some distance away, you've got a much lower probability of detection. So
this sounds quite intensive. You can't have done the whole country in this way.
No, absolutely. We did a study area of some 240 square kilometres. And within this, we intensively drove distance transects. We drove very long distances each year. And by measuring the distance with the with a image intensifier and a laser rangefinder to every deer that we detected, you're able to model the detection function, and therefore you're able to actually scientifically estimate the density, and we were able to measure the density of deer in our landscape.
But then is it just an extrapolation to go from there across the UK, which presumably has some risks, given that what your local area is like is not like the Highlands of Scotland or the South of Wales or whatever?
It would be completely unreliable to extrapolate from the densities we see to try and estimate the population of the UK, and we have not done that. What is more reliable is, well, two things. Firstly, by counting the deer and then measuring the fertility from the larder data, from the shooting where people check the fetus in the deer, we're able to measure what the fertility and the output of the production of the population is. From that, we know what percentage of the population would need to be culled. Now, that is probably...
And where does this idea come from that the number to be culled is getting close to 50% or beyond?
Well, if you measure the fertility of muntjac, then that shows you need to cull 50% of the population just to hold it steady in the landscape we were working in, and probably in other comparable landscapes in much of southern and lowland England.
And just to make the probably to you obvious point, why, even if there are all these extra deer, do they need to be culled? People are going to go, well, even if there are a couple of million deer in the UK, there's 60 million people, it's a big country, what's the problem?
Absolutely, that's really important. So we have already a very large body of scientific evidence showing, on the one hand, that deer are having severe impacts in our woodlands. We've got to remember that deer have been functionally absent from certainly the English countryside for many centuries. Roe deer were virtually extinct. Red deer were restricted to a few very localised populations, really hanging on by the tips of their hooves, as it were. And then the Victorians introduced seeker deer. The fallow deer escaped from parks, muntjac deer were introduced, Chinese water deer were introduced, and deer numbers have increased and increased. So we have more deer now in the British landscape than we've had at any time since the Ice Age.
How practical would it be, though, to increase by what would be hundreds of thousands the number of deer killed each year?
There are very many stalkers who... I mean, let's be honest, their hobby is stalking and shooting deer. And they are there's a large number of stalkers looking for ground to shoot deer on. There's a large number of landowners with a deer management problem. It's a question of bringing the two together. And this is something that the Deer Initiative have been successfully doing. We already have active deer management across many parts of the UK.
And I'm sure some people might see this as good news, meaning that deer is cheap, if that's not an oxymoron. But would this automatically lead to cheaper venison?
I don't know if increasing the size of the cull would reduce venison prices, but certainly I would advocate people going into their local gastropub and saying, have you got muntjac on the menu? The only way that an increased deer cull can be supported as if it has public support, and it is providing wild free-ranged meat of known provenance. This is a sustainably harvested wild animal where we know where it comes from.
But what about the Bambi factor? Aren't a lot of people going to be uncomfortable with the notion of killing those literally doe-eyed creatures?
I imagine so. No one is suggesting that we eradicate deer from the countryside. We want to see deer in the countryside. They're a really important part of our natural heritage. People want to see deer when they go walking their dog, when they go into the countryside. But for a vegetarian or for a vegan to say, I do not want to eat any animal, you have to respect that position. Mm. But for someone who's prepared to go to a supermarket and purchase meat, but then says, oh, I'm not prepared to accept you harvesting a wild animal humanely and sustainably, there's a certain inconsistency in that position.
OK, Dr. Paul Dolman, many thanks. As Bob Dylan put it, it's not dark yet, but it's getting there. After nearly 4 years in orbit, the largest infrared space telescope ever launched is about to close its eye on the universe. The billion-euro Herschel Space Observatory hasn't lost contact with Earth or run out of fuel. It's perilously low on coolant. Although, given how phenomenally cold it gets in space, you might not think coolant would be quite so critical to the telescope continuing to function. To explain why Herschel will soon go blind and what its loss means for space astronomy, I'm joined by astrophysicist Dr. Dave Clements from Imperial College in London. Dave, you were here with us when the observatory was launched almost 4 years ago, so it now seems like we've come full Herschel circle. Has it exceeded your expectations?
It's been phenomenally successful. In mere hours, for the kind of thing I do, which is looking at surveys of dusty galaxies, both near to us and at great distances, Herschel, in a matter of a few hours, has wiped the floor with what's been done from the surface of the Earth in years. So it really has been more than a quantum leap in our capability.
Quantum leap, something very small and random.
Exactly. It's a much bigger than that. Monstrously.
Monstrously, that's right.
In our capability. And it's going to leave a huge legacy of stuff that we are still going to be sifting through for years to come and looking at things we pick up with Herschel at other wavelengths to understand what's actually going on in them.
Okay, huge legacy. Any particular favourite find among all that?
Oh, my own favourites are looking at the high redshift universe, looking at very distant dusty galaxies. And we're certainly finding some of those. And hopefully I'll be able to be a bit more concrete in some of the very interesting discoveries we've made about distant galaxies, about gravitational lensing of dusty galaxies, if you invite me back at some point in the future.
Oh, that's a teaser.
Once we've published the data.
Oh, OK. And why, just to explain, why the need to do all this not by using visible light, but by looking at the infrared and beyond?
What we're seeing with the infrared is actually dust emission. So this is where starlight and the light from supermassive black holes or light from young stars in star formation regions in our own galaxy has been absorbed by dust and then the dust warms up a little bit and we see it radiated at much longer wavelengths than the optical. So we're comparing surface temperatures of stars are a few thousand degrees, and the temperature of the dust we're seeing with Herschel is about maybe 40 or 50 degrees above absolute zero. So we're talking Kelvin here, not 40 or 50 degrees above freezing point. So it's much colder than that. And you just can't see the emission from dust at that temperature in the optical. In fact, you see the exact opposite. This dust is absorbing visible light and taking that light away. So if you look through the plane of our own galaxy, for example, you'll see these big black patches. That's not where there are no stars. It's where there's lots of dust absorbing the light from the stars, so you can't see the stars behind
it. So you actually turn the problem into the solution by moving to the infrared.
Exactly, yes. And you can see through the dust and essentially see what's invisible in the optical. So you can look and see, for example, the Horsehead Nebula. You can see what's going on inside the Horsehead Nebula, which is an absorbing region, work in the infrared, mid-infrared, far-infrared. And you can see, as one of my colleagues said in a paper, see what the horse has swallowed. And look and see its star formation regions inside the Horsehead Nebula.
It's nice to see what the horse has swallowed being used in a positive sense for a change at the moment. And why does all this require you to have these instruments, really some of these instruments, cooled down so much, especially given that you're in what we think of as being one of the coldest things we know of, deep space?
Well, to actually be able to detect the radiation, we're looking at wavelengths of a few hundred microns. The only detectors we've got that can do that have to be at very low temperatures, not just a few degrees Kelvin, but below that, 0.3 degrees of above absolute zero. And that's for the detectors. There's also the electronics that goes with them and keeping the telescope cool.
And the coolant then becomes the limiting factor. And it's probably worth making clear, it's not like this Mars Curiosity rover having to be shut down this week because of a software glitch. This was something expected. It was always sort of known the coolant was the limiting factor for this mission.
The design lifetime of Herschel was 3.5 years with 3 years of scientific operations. We've beaten that.
By about 3 months at the moment, haven't
you? Yeah, 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
And that was always the design lifetime. The helium was there. The helium was always going to be boiling off as we cool the instruments down and keep everything else cold. And that's just the way it is with the technology we're using at the moment.
And given that it's an incredible achievement to get a telescope with a mirror this big, what is it, 13.5 metres?
No,
is it?
It's 3.5 metres across.
Sorry, 3.5 metres. Yeah. Sorry, I've added a 10 there. Still, 3.5 metres across mirror into space to have it up there, to have it all be limited by the coolant. Is there any way to have another mission where you can get somehow find a way around that limiting factor?
Well, we can't do a top-up
because
Herschel's 1.5 million kilometres away. It's just difficult.
It's a long way off, yes.
But the next mission being planned is actually a Japanese-led mission called Speaker. Not fully sorted yet, but we're in well into the planning and preparation stage. That will use a new generation of mechanical coolers. So kind of like the thing you have in your own fridge, but working at much lower temperatures. And the only limiting factor on those, apart from wear and tear, they will eventually wear out, is power. So as long as you've got big enough solar panels, you can keep, or you will be able to keep the speaker running for maybe 5 years before something breaks, or maybe even longer if the mechanics of the fridges are well built and reliable.
And even though Herschel itself has only got a few weeks, possibly months left to run, we'll still be crunching the data and finding things in it for a long time.
Oh, yet. Absolutely. We've got hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of galaxies, the ones that I'm interested in. There's huge legacy surveys looking at the plane of our own galaxy, looking at star formation regions, looking even at planets and comets. So there's a huge amount of stuff. We need to sit down and go through this in an organised fashion rather than just seeing the data come pouring in on us, which is what's been the case up until now.
OK, might need to have you back more than once then. Dr. Dave Clements, thank you. And continuing with our musically inspired intros, as Aretha Franklin sang, "Whenever I wake up, I put on my makeup." But why? It may seem a daft question, it may be a daft question, but why do so many of us go to so much trouble to transform the way we look rather than presenting ourselves to the world as we are? On the face of it, it may seem obvious, but until now, there's been precious little research on the subject. Now, a just-published paper has gone behind a painted smile, top five for the Isley Brothers, 1969, to establish why. On the line is lead author Richard Russell, Assistant Professor of Psychology at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. Richard Russell, research on cosmetics often focuses on attractiveness and beauty, but you, I think, have chosen to focus on age perception. Why?
Well, I think age perception is, or how old someone looks, is really a critical part of our general sense of who they are and what they look like. And it is actually related to how healthy we perceive someone to be. Certainly a lot of people would like to appear, depending on their age, either older or younger than they are.
And as far as you were concerned, was this link between this and makeup something that was literally, metaphorically, dermatologically staring us in the face?
That's right. Yeah. It's something that this cue that we've discovered for aging is something that's right there. We can all see it, but it's something that we haven't been consciously aware of.
But given you've got different people of different ages with different looks and vastly different makeup regimes, all presumably slapping on different amounts, how do you go about getting any kind of quantitative data out of all this?
Well, in this study, we weren't measuring makeup use. We were actually looking at faces without any makeup.
So you're looking at the effects of it rather than the makeup itself?
Well, that's right. Well, not even that. We were looking at how the face changes with age.
Right.
So what we found was that by measuring images of faces that range in age from 20 to 70, that the contrast, a certain kind of contrast in the face, decreased with age. So the older faces actually have less of this contrast than the younger faces.
With the suggestion presumably being that this could then be manipulated by correct use of makeup to compensate.
That's right, because the kind of contrast that decreased was the contrast between the facial features, the lips, the eyes, and the eyebrows, with the surrounding skin. So, for example, we found that the redness of the lips decreases through aging, but the skin that surrounds the lips actually becomes more red. And so the redness contrast between the lips and the rest of the face decreases with age, and that certainly is something that can be manipulated through lipstick.
And when you say you found this, is this somebody stuff that nobody's actually sat down and noted before?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And essentially, it was the idea that if you then could know the age of each subject you'd had a photograph taken of and had a measure for the facial contrast, you could then see how that tallied with how old they were assessed as being by other people.
That's right. That's right. And we found that faces with higher facial contrast were perceived as appearing younger. So people, when we asked them to estimate how old they looked, we found a clear relationship between the facial contrast and the estimate of the age.
I suppose there are some very obvious cues we use to guess somebody's age. They're the wrinkles, how grey their hair is, how there their hair is, whether they're carrying a bus pass. Are you saying that facial contrast is another that perhaps we're less aware of but might be just as important?
That's right, yeah. So something like wrinkles, for example, this is a real clear cue to age. My four-year-old daughter could tell you that as people get older that they have more wrinkles. And that is a very large cue to age. We use wrinkles when we're perceiving how old someone is. If I artificially, let's say, increase the number of wrinkles on my own face, then people would think that I looked older. And so we measured facial contrast in this way. We manipulated these photographs of the faces, which were not wearing makeup, but we increased or decreased the contrast and then asked people to just indicate how old the face looked in one study. And in another, we actually paired the two versions of the same face and said, you know, which face looks younger? And we found that in virtually all of the trials that subjects picked the higher contrast version of the face as appearing younger.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, not everyone wearing makeup wants to look younger. Did you also do anything about, say, teenagers who might be attempting to seem older than they are?
Right, yeah, absolutely fascinating question there. We didn't here because we weren't looking at how people used makeup. And we also, the study only had faces ranging from 20 to 70 years of age. My suspicion is that just from looking at children's faces, I think that contrast actually decreases really beginning from a younger age than 20, that probably if we looked at younger faces, we would see that there's a decline that begins earlier than the age of 20.
But you did also try taking some photos and kind of artificially increasing and decreasing to see the kind of luminance, to see what effect that had.
That's right. And when we increased the contrast in the face, the faces actually appeared younger. Whereas when we decrease them, decrease the contrast in the face, then that face, that person, looked older. So this really indicates pretty clearly that we're using this contrast cue to perceive how old someone is.
Okay, Richard Russell, very interesting. Perhaps we need to think of it less as make-up, more as make-down, as in make your age go down. The Material World web pages within bbc.co.uk/radio4 have more on face values. You'll also find a cavalcade of past programmes, details of how to receive our free weekly podcast, and multiple ways of getting in touch with us should the urge come upon you. Following last week's final, slightly squeezed item on using language evolution analysis to work out when Homer might have written the Iliad and the Odyssey, a couple of people wrote in to say it was a pity that Mark Pagel didn't have a chance to come back after I queried what we gained by the research. Research that predicted with 95% certainty they were written between an implausibly early 1157 BCE and an impossibly late 376 BCE. So, it seemed a good idea to call up Mark, Professor of Evolutionary Biology at Reading, and get his response.
Our model, based solely on Homer's vocabulary, predicts that the Iliad was written in the middle of the 8th century. This is in striking agreement with many classicists and historians who base their views on history, archaeology, and linguistic references in the Iliad. Your worry, Quentin, seemed to be that the wide confidence intervals around our preferred date meant that we couldn't rule out many other possible dates for Homer. But this ignores the fact that our model regards these extreme outcomes as highly improbable, even if possible, based on language use alone. So contrary to your remarks, we learn that language can quite remarkably date important events of human history.
Mark Pabel could respond to his response, but we'll stop before this becomes an odyssey of our own. Now, also buried among the latest pile of emails, we found this.
Dear Quinton, I'm a regular listener to your excellent programme. A paper from my lab on the humble spud will be appearing in the journal Nature. In brief, we have found that naturally occurring mutations in a single potato gene have allowed the potato to travel the world and be successfully cultivated far from its Andean origins. If this sounds like an interesting topic for your program, I will be happy to talk about it. Best regards, Christian.
A single gene that's propelled the potato across the planet, and which means every tatty everywhere is effectively a chip off the same old Andean block. How could that not sound interesting? So, since Christian was happy to talk about it, he's on the line, and he's more formally Dr. Christian Backham from the Laboratory of Plant Breeding at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. So, Christian, how did you come to stumble upon this one gene that enabled the potato to conquer the world?
Well, hello.
Hello.
It's been known for quite some time that potato varies as to when it makes its tubers during the growing season, and there's a large sort of variation. And using basically genetic techniques, you can home in on this gene by mapping it using something called QTL mapping, which is a bit like Mendelian mapping. And you can then find a region of the genome which seems where the trait seems to be located.
But am I right in thinking you were only able to do this because we've actually sequenced the genome of the potato and you were one of those who was involved in that?
Exactly, yes, I was. And I was the international coordinator of the Potato Genome Sequencing Consortium. And this sequence has helped tremendously in then narrowing down this region far more precisely to only a handful of genes that could have been possible candidates for this earliness gene.
So you already suspected or thought there would be a gene that did this and you were able to find out what it was. You already hypothesised the whole success of the potato comes down to its ability to cope with what you call earliness.
Right. Although we were not at all sure that it was going to be one gene, we actually thought for a long time that it's going to be a whole plethora of genes. But mapping down and homing in on this region, we eventually found that, you know, it's probably one gene. And by transferring this single gene from this very early genotype into another potato, which doesn't normally make tubers here in these northern latitudes under long day conditions, we were able to make these normally potatoes that don't make tubers. We were able to make tubers on those potatoes carrying this new gene, and there they go. They make potatoes really early in the season, and so we had the evidence that this was likely to be the one gene, the single gene that does the job.
And is it the gene itself that's so potato empowering, or is it the fact that it's a gene that's very mutable and it's allowed the potato, when it's been taken to different countries and different climates, to adapt to them?
Well, we don't know exactly how this came about. My feeling is that this gene and this mutation in this gene, which is really that it's lost its back end, and it's that back end that normally is targeted by another protein that degrades it. So it's lost this ability to be degraded, and therefore it sticks around. And the fact that it sticks around in the cell means that the potatoes always make tubers early. And it's this mutant and various different versions of this mutant gene that we found now in potatoes that we now grow in modern cultivars in Northern Europe. So whether this gene originated from the Andes as a mutant or actually the mutation occurred later on, we don't know. We're going to do more research to try and find out sort of the how this gene travelled and where it occurred.
So how would the history have developed? And when the first potato crops, or well, the first potatoes, came to the UK with the conquistadors, would a lot of them simply have failed?
Well, probably. In fact, they took them to Spain and Italy first. I think
well,
they only
I suppose
came
that's the conquistadors'
later.
First point of call. Yes,
exactly. So, my feeling is they took potatoes, but they ate them on the way home. So they probably also took a bag of seeds, which was then a very wide genetic variation of different potato genotypes, which they sowed out. And indeed, probably a lot of those just failed to make tubers. They grew, but they didn't make tubers because it was long day conditions in the summer, so they wouldn't make them. In amongst those, there were a few of these mutants probably that did make tubers early, and they were, of course, probably one of the first selections. Plant breeding wasn't really established then, but the farmers will have selected these out and said, wow, these make tubers early, so we'll carry on with those. And as they went north, of course, they selected more and more extreme genotypes, which were less and less susceptible to this regulation system.
Any thoughts on why this has happened in the potato? But there isn't anything exactly equivalent to this in most other vegetables that have made it quite so prolific, quite so successful as the potato.
Well, the potato is very successful, and it isn't so humble, like I said in my email. Yeah. It's actually, you know, we've
mighty.
We have three, yeah, you know, the mighty potato. How this precisely occurred is unknown, but it's. And why the potato produces both seeds, because it does produce little berries and it produces little seeds and flowers, certainly the wild types do. It's probably a sort of dual strategy for survival. The tuber is for short-term survival and the seeds are for long-term survival. And in the Andes, where you have long periods of drought, especially during the winter, it's very advantageous to have a hydrated, so a wet system where the tubers will sprout and give the new generation a nice kick start. On the other hand, you don't want to only have clonal propagation. You also want to have sexual reproduction to allow new genes to be shuffled around. So having this dual strategy makes the potato extremely successful.
OK, thank you. We have to leave it there. Dr. Christian Backham, thank you for that and for also drawing the email to our attention in the first place. As A.A. Milne said, if a man really likes potatoes, he must be a pretty decent sort of fellow. If you want to comment on this, anything else we've done or not done, we are material.world@bbc.co.uk.